Hello. Welcome back to the David Watson podcast. Hope you're all well. Today, I was lucky enough to speak with Michelle, the author of Soulmate Dog. And in that process of talking with Michelle, I got to do a couple of my favorite things. Talk about dogs. There is nothing better in life than my dog. And also that connection that we can have with another living being, be it a person, a dog, cat, horse, budgie, all of us, well, hopefully all of us will have know that experience where you have this unique connection with an animal that can't be explained, but you understand it. And we got into that, what that meant, and the grieving process and how you deal with that when it's finished. So I hope you enjoy this episode. Hello, welcome to the David Watson podcast. How are you?
Oh, yes, good morning. Very well, thank you. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. I'm very good. I'm very well and intrigued. Yeah, when I first got the invite from Flora to speak with you, just intrigued about the book, intrigued about the background, resisted looking up Debbie McGilvy.
How's it
McGillivray. Resisted looking her up because once I saw what she did, I was like, I need to ask you all the questions. I don't want to find out anything for myself. But also, obviously, did it all start with Brady?
Yes.
So let's start there. Explain to everybody who Brady is.
Yes. So Brady is the protagonist of my forthcoming book, Soulmate Dog. And he was my soulmate dog. And I write about his story and his life and some aspects of it that greatly impacted mine that I thought would be meaningful for a lot of people out there. And so he was a German Shepherd, and he taught me a lot over the course of his life. So that's why I wrote a book about him.
So what happened?
So Brady contracted, it was really love at first sight, as I write in my book, between me and Brady. And so I would have done anything for him. I would have cut off my leg if it would have saved him in some way.
Yeah, of course.
And so when he was about 6 years old, he contracted a mysterious disease. We didn't know what it was at first, but we went right to the emergency hospital. He proceeded to spend about 2 months of his life in the emergency hospital. I was with him constantly. It ended up being leptospirosis, David, which is a spirochetal disease that affects dogs in different ways. But for him, it gave him acute kidney failure. And so he was at the emergency hospital attached to an IV, getting fluids at an alarmingly high rate to keep his creatinine levels down. And that's what happened to him. That's what prompted, it was the genesis of wanting to write this book, because the vets did save his life and he went on to live. I won't say too much because it is in the book, but he did go on to have a high quality life for a good while after that. And between what the vets did for him at the emergency hospital and then his holistic vets who continued his care, all the vets said that I needed to write a book about him because he was against all the odds.
And so that's Soulmate Dog. It's one of the things that's interesting. I have a Staffordshire Bull Terrier called Molly, and I don't actually know how old she is because she's a rescue dog. Her owners were dying. And my mum always says that Molly was a Godwink, because at the time, I've had her 4 years, and the year before I'd had a pretty disastrous year, both physically and in my, you know, personally with friendships and stuff. And I, you know, definitely was feeling, you know, deflated, definitely rejected by life and rejected as a person, you know, like everything failed. And then there's this dog whose owner is dying and nobody wants her, like nobody wanted her. And he couldn't get his kids, he was dying, he knew he was dying. His kids didn't want her, you know, like nobody. And I ended up with her. And it was just, as you say, it just clicked. It was love at first sight. And yeah, just from that moment on, 4 years ago, we've definitely just helped each other heal. You know, she knows I absolutely adore her, and she definitely adores me to the extent she'll ignore other people the minute I walk through the door.
Yes, I understand it perfectly. It's normal. It makes perfect sense to me, and that's just it. It's soulmate dog because it is true interspecies love. And when you say that you had a rough year, I think that dogs are not just dogs, and I devote a whole section to that in a sort of philosophy section, that a dog is not just a dog. They have these faculties that we don't attribute to them, but they are very healing, and they sympathize and empathize and are affectionate and can certainly perceive our sadnesses. And it's such a complex, deep relationship. So
Yeah,
I
it is, because
fully understand.
I never even met her owner. He was a friend of my uncle's, you know, and like she'd been passed around three or four different houses or homes, you know, with people until he eventually died. And it's just like what David said, he'll have her, because I'd looked after her for a few weeks, like 6 months before he died. And it feels a bit awkward trying to explain it, because she has a look that she only has, that she only looks at me. And there's a level of excitement when I turn up, and she'll run around everybody in the house barking when the car pulls up. And it's like, I'm telling everyone I'm home. And then when she sees me, there's times when she, and I don't know why it makes me uncomfortable saying it, but it does. So I'm just going to sort of say, she makes me feel that I'm lovable because of the way she looks at me sometimes. She like looks at me and she's like, I fucking love you. You are the best thing I've ever had in my life. You are everything. And I just look at her and I'm just like, I don't know how this happened. And I don't know what I did to deserve it. But this dog, she genuinely puts all her trust in me. And I
Yes,
just,
you
and
are her soulmate human.
And it's just like, and we are, do you know what I mean? She never gets on my nerves. I never get annoyed of her. And if I'm just stood there, she just comes and sits next to me. And because my brother nicknames her Velcro, and she's just always stuck to my side.
That's it, because you're her soulmate human, and there's no reason to feel uncomfortable saying that. I think that the love that we have, and I write about this in my book, like this sort of Aristotelian love, it's this unconditional love. And that's absolutely what's so beautiful about it, is that there really are no conditions. And the love between, I think, a dog and its person it is absolutely complex,
It's the
but it's
way they
not.
express it. It's the way they have a look, and they look at you, and it's like you can just, shit, that dog really loves me. That dog just thinks I'm amazing. And they give you this look that you can't perceive yourself in that way, and you're just like, cool. I've never felt this before.
Yes,
I'm not trying to call out any ex-girlfriends or anything. I'm just saying you never did it like that.
My partner at the time used to call Brady my fiance as a joke, because the love between me and Brady was so strong that everybody knew that they like didn't quite hold a torch to Brady. And that's just how it was. That's just how it was. And I think that there is this level of communication. Now, I was just speaking with his vet because we're going to do Dr. Nate Heilman, who appears frequently in the book. He's a major character. He's like a modern Saint Francis who cares for the animals in this really profound way. But he said to me recently that I wasn't even in the building. I was still, like, I hadn't even walked in the door. And Brady was, he knew I was there. And he would be there for the day getting fluids and acupuncture and these Chinese herbs that were really valuable to his health in his late years. But he already knew I was there, was the thing. And so by the time I walked in the door, they were already preparing him to go because they knew that I was there based on his reaction. He would perk up and come to the ready and while I was just driving into the parking lot. So there's this deep knowing, and that does come along with the animal communication that is far beyond what the five senses would dictate. It's really profound.
It is, because I mean, Molly has a few strange habits. Like if I go away, so when I'm here, she sleeps on my bed. But if I'm not in the, if I'm working away, she doesn't, she stays downstairs. Yeah, and it's all these funny little quirks. She won't sleep on anyone else's bed. She won't go in anyone else's room. But if I'm not there, she won't sleep on the bed. She stays downstairs. And no one makes her. The door's always open for her to do what she wants. She just chooses
right.
not to. And, but it's funny that they, like I say, that thing about how they show you how much they love you, and kind of it takes you back a little bit, because I guess because we as humans we feel undeserving of it, or maybe we don't experience it the same way. Because you said a very good point about how unconditional it is, and for the only thing I can really figure out that I do exceptionally well is get her a good variety of snacks. So it's just like, I'm not really sure how I bargained my way into this position of her heart.
You know, I don't think, honestly, that we need to feel that's what unconditional love is, David. It's not that you need to prove yourself or be worthy or present your CV to Molly. That's what unconditional love is. It's a recognition of who you are and a love for who you are without placing these conditions on it. That's what's so beautiful and precious
it is,
about
it.
It
is. But I think that's also, sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off, but that's what makes it so difficult to comprehend, because in humans, and it's not necessarily the truth, but our own insecurities can make us feel like we have to bargain ourselves to prove some worth. And then you have a dog that, well, lots of animals who connect with their owners do it, but it's like, no, there's no bargaining chips. You just, as you are, it's absolutely fine. It's all I need. I don't need anything else. That's perfect. And it doesn't matter what day you're having, what you look like, what you feel like. It's just, well, no, I just think you're amazing as you are. And it's like,
yes, it's so true. And, you know, in the first book that I wrote, Starving to Heal in Siberia, I wrote about how I always struggled with being a perfectionist. And, you know, I have a PhD, but it was always like my next project, or like, then I have to do this, then I have to accomplish this research project. And it was never enough for myself. And I write about that in Starving to Heal. And then, you know, in both that book and in Soulmate Dog, I write about how I was very ill with late stage Lyme disease. And Brady was with me a good part of the time when I was sick with Lyme disease. And it meant that we couldn't go hiking the way that we would normally do. And I was in, you know, my old flannel PJs, and we had to just kind of cuddle up because I couldn't do the things that I could normally do. But he was always so clear, like that was just perfect for him. We didn't have to do anything or be anything. He was more than happy to just exist with me. And I really think, David, that in the process of being with Brady and having my soulmate dog relationship with him, that my own sense of worthiness increased exponentially. And now I think I'm an extremely secure person and feel pretty worthy of all the love and the unconditional love. If you want to love me unconditionally, great, I accept and thank you. So I feel like he just taught me so much about that.
Yeah, no, it's definitely, it's a brilliant way of looking at it and trying to understand it. And there's elements that, like I said, have fascinated me because as human beings, we don't seem to, even when we have these great relationships with people, it could be friends, lovers, whatever, who do accept us, we seem to struggle accepting ourselves within the framework of that relationship. But when you connect with adults, and I grew up with dogs, so I've always been lucky that they've always been around me. But when you have that connection with them, when they single you out as, no, you're the one for me, it's at another level again. And you just, I remember somebody recently, you know, they just doing hypothetical questions. They're like, you know, if the world was going to end tomorrow, what would you do? And I was just like, I wouldn't really care. I'd just hang out with the dog for the day. And as I was saying that, I realized how content I would be. I'd just sit with the dog for the day. If it's the last thing I get to do for 24 hours, then I'm just going to hang out with my dog. Family can be there or not. I'm not fussed. I'll just, the dogs, that's all I literally care about. Or at least it's right at the top of the hierarchy of caring.
No, I completely understand. I mean, that is why it is that sort of like soul level kind of love. And, you know, as I also write in Soulmate Dog, you know, my ideal day was being able to spend the day with Brady and not leaving our property and just sort of communing together. He didn't even like to have his breakfast alone. Like, he wanted me to be sitting down next to him, at least having a coffee or berries or something while he was eating. He wouldn't start having his breakfast until I was sitting down next to him. He was just kind of waiting for me. And so it was like we had this deep level of communing in our quotidian life that we were so content that, to the point that my ideal day was just being able to spend the day with him. Someone could invite me to the opera or something, and I'd be like, oh, thank you very much. I have other plans. My other plan was Brady.
Yeah.
So, you know, because I wanted to be with him, because I appreciated the quality of our rapport so highly. And then, you know, when you talk about Debbie McGillivray bringing in the level of the animal communication, just rendered it so much more profound. And like, you have a painting where suddenly all of these details are added, and so that just brought a whole nother level of
How did you learn from that? How what was the learning process?
Which part of it? Of me myself learning to communicate, or
all of it?
Learning that Brady could.
I'll take all of them. Thank you.
Okay. Yes. So once again, so I had never heard of animal communication, and a friend mentioned that she worked with an animal communicator to telepathically communicate with her cat. Now, as a trained skeptic in philosophy and literature, all of my radar was on full alert.
You thought this woman was batshit crazy, in other words.
I did think that. And I thought that I also wouldn't be caught dead speaking to an animal communicator, and all of my academic credentials would be taken away from me if I ever did so. Still, at the same time, I went home and I thought about it, and I thought, well, it would be really wonderful if I actually could communicate with Brady the way that she says that she can. A good couple of months went by before I worked up the courage to actually ask her for this animal communicator's information, and I made an appointment, and I write about all of this in Soulmate Dog at length, because it was absolutely fascinating to me. But when I spoke with her, and Brady came in, it was so incredibly clear that I was in direct communication with Brady. I mean, I really just about fell off my chair. And what really clinched it in that conversation was that Debbie McGillivray always also does these body scans. So in addition to having a full conversation where she's transmitting to what your animal is thinking, how it feels about a variety of things. And then she did this body scan and she said, you know, you should take Brady to an animal chiropractor because something like his fourth lumbar is out, something like that, one of the discs in his lower spine. I thought, very well. At that afternoon, I booked an appointment for that very day, I think, with the chiropractor, and we went. I didn't, of course, say that I had spoken to an animal communicator because, once again, I would have been at that point humiliated to state that to someone in the medical community. And she checked him out and she said, oh, yes, the disc in his fourth lumbar is out. And I was like, this, oh my God. So it was exactly, she was just confirming what Debbie had calmly stated. And that was the first of thousands of details. But when it came time for us to be in the emergency hospital, by that time I had already gone through Debbie's training program, so I could communicate with Brady myself. And the original title of this book was Soulmate Dog, Becoming Fluent in the Language of Dog. And then the publisher thought that because there were a few tacks to this book, Holistic Vet Care, Animal Communication, the philosophical relationship between the animal and human, and then also grief and loss, they wanted to take out the becoming fluent in the language of dog. But for me, it was a very big deal to go through this animal communication training and be able to speak with Brady and other animals too. To go through it, Debbie had me communicating with a variety of different animals. And so by the time we did reach the emergency hospital, it was extremely valuable to be able to communicate with him and see how he was really feeling there beyond just looking at him attached to these machines, looking miserable. And it just shaped, David, the entire way that I ever thought about animals. And I've written academic articles on the philosophical relationship between the animal and the human. All of that went out the window after I learned what a dog was really capable of.
Yeah.
So
what's, because it is a difficult one. There's times that, yeah, there's times that I've seen or heard things, and you'll never get me to. So for reference, so background, I wrote a book on reincarnation about 10 years ago, because there's just things that I had to write down because it just didn't make sense any other way. And the book was kind of a way of dealing with that, which sounds more cryptic than it's supposed to, but there was a point to write in the book, and it wasn't just about the book, if you know what I mean. It was a cathartic way of getting thoughts down on paper that I turned into a story. And you talk about dealing with the grief. What is it that, because sometimes I've seen it where somebody losing a pet can be worse than losing a family member.
Mm-hmm.
And grief is, I think one of the things that's very complicated about grief is we expect it to finish. And that kind of puts a false timeline on it.
So it's interesting that you would say that. I I didn't expect grief to finish because when I was a girl, I lost my mother, and I was very close to her. It took me years to process my mother's death, and so I actually start the book with that because I had meant to start the book with Brady going into the emergency hospital, but my editor thought, the reader has got to understand, Mish, why this dog is so important to you, why your love for this dog is so profound. They have to know that you already know grief, that you already know loss, that you know what it means to love so profoundly and to lose someone that you love beyond all. And so the editor made me write an opening chapter on losing my mom when I was a girl. And so I became somewhat of an expert in grief as a result of that early loss, and really throwing myself into what it means to grieve and to grieve. And so when I lost Brady, and when I wrote about it, and I have a whole coda in Soulmate Dog devoted to the grieving process, because so many books, David, end and the dog dies. The dog dies, the book is over, you've become invested in this dog, you feel a love for this dog, and there's this lurch in your heart, and you're left to grieve this dog you've just read about on your own, and you don't even know how to do it. And I wanted to sort of hold the reader's hand and also share my own messy, raw process of grieving. So I wrote grief in the coda. I wrote how I grieve. I journal, I walk it off, and I don't have a timeline for it. But it was a way of honoring my bond with Brady. And I said, we don't know how to even grieve our people sometimes, let alone knowing how to grieve our dog. And so I thought that writing this coda could be deeply comforting to my readers who may be struggling with their own losses of their own soulmate dogs or cats or horses, whatever they may be. And that my own way of processing it, with deep compassion for myself and honoring Brady all along the way, honoring all of the feelings that I was experiencing, I felt that that would be of some value to readers because you don't usually get that in a book. So my book does not end with Brady dying.
It's an interesting one that it flabbergasts me sometimes because if you really love someone, or in this case, like with Brady and with me, with Molly, and and it's in the past and stuff like that, and you have a connection with them, it seems absurd that somebody f that there's this idea that you wouldn't miss them. That it wouldn't leave a gaping hole in your life. And it's not a hole that you want filled. You're just acknowledging that the hole's there. And that this, in your case, Brady had this amazing positive impact. And sometimes it's just simple as, no, I just miss that. I just miss the way we made each other feel. I'm not trying to replace it. I don't want to renew it. I appreciate the process, but I'm never not going to. There'll never be a day when I don't miss that.
Absolutely. I think it's so important to just simply acknowledge that. Just acknowledge that, state it, feel it, allow yourself to feel it. Yes, I will absolutely always miss Brady, and it'd be interesting to see what you wrote in your reincarnation book. But I do embrace that possibility as well. And I think that you can't have a love like that without experiencing profound grief.
Yeah, it's not, and it's just the way that people, that there always seems to, we always seem to put rules, restrictions into something. Like there's, everyone says it's a process. It's when the cliche is time heals everything, but the important thing that people miss about that cliche is it doesn't dictate what time means. It just says time heals everything. It's a great healer, but time itself is a limitation. But the phrase doesn't have a limitation in it. It doesn't put a beginning or an end to that time. But we, or people, try to. I find that if you talk to somebody that's had a deep connection with a pet, they understand immediately that no, that there's always a hole. And weirdly, we embrace the idea that we can have this connection again with another dog or another cat or another horse. And we almost open ourselves up to look like Swiss cheese by the time we get to the end of our own life. We're just these holes that ironically are not empty. They've been filled. But it's a funny process that we all take ourselves through, always appreciating. Even now in my own house, we talk about all the previous dogs and their own unique characters and what they brought to us as a family, what they brought to the household. And we all have our own special memories of them.
Yes, absolutely. I think that, you know, with the case of Brady, you know, I had the cover of my book is this portrait of Brady, and it's a portrait that I had commissioned of a favorite photograph I had of him. He used to love to climb this tree and then watch people walking by in the neighborhood. He would just sit in the tree and watch people walking by. It was so majestic and so him. And so I had this painting commissioned, and it's in my foyer, and I walk by and I see him every day. But I have a child, and the book is actually dedicated to her, and dedication for Snow. Her name is Snow. And she will say to me when I'm telling stories, she will say, "Well, don't forget, Brady was your first love," because I will tell her, "You are my love," and she's like, "Yes, and Brady was your first." She always includes him in our family in any story that I'm telling, because I've always told her stories about him, and so she knows just how incredibly important he was. So I keep him alive in that way, and our sort of family oral history. But, you know, people would say to me right after Brady died, "Oh, you need to get another dog right now." And I was like, I can't possibly do that. You know, if my child died, I wouldn't just go out and make another child right away. I'm grieving. I couldn't possibly, my heart couldn't even take care of another animal right now. And I know that everyone deals with death and loss in different ways, and that works for some people. But for me, I had to take all of the time in the world to honor my grief and our relationship, and I couldn't have done that.
No, that makes perfect sense to me. I mean, between Molly, we've always had all our dogs have always been rescues. We've never purchased a dog. It's always been a dog that somebody didn't want, so we just we'll take it. It's fine.
That's extraordinary, and just shows how worthy you are of that unconditional love.
Thank you. That's very kind of you to say so. And our dog before Toby was a collie, and when he passed away, I think it was three years before another dog, which was Molly, came along. And that's the longest we've ever gone for about a dog. And we, all of us were like, probably need to think about getting a dog. But it just never happened. It never clicked. It never happened. And then got a phone call off my uncle. And Molly's dad owner was dying. And said, okay, we'll take her. And then he came out of hospital. So we didn't see her again for about 3 or 4 months. And it was like, all right, maybe this isn't going to happen. And then and it did. And just, yeah. And she, and that was 4 years ago. And, but it was funny that it was almost exactly like you're saying, it was almost waiting for the grief for Toby to fade significantly enough that we could allow someone else in.
Yes, because it's such an important relationship. It has to be honored. It has to be recognized for the value. And that's what grief, that is, you know, what grief is. And I don't agree with the statement that time heals everything. I think you can't just sit back and let time do it. So you have to do your own processing, your own grieving, you're doing your own active process. And it's just that it takes a lot of time. And it has to. That's just a reflection of how deep the love is and how deep the relationship is.
It's complicated because you can set up a shrine, you can have like memory walks. There's all these little things you can do, and there's that balance between sitting in the grief and remembering the happy times. And it's you want to remember the happy times, but you want to move to a place where you can be open again for someone else. I'm you know, another dog or another cat. Because otherwise you find yourself, you know, I could easily see myself in myself if I didn't take a positive step to forever sit in the grief.
Yeah, I would say that that corresponds nicely to, you know, Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's 5 stages of grief. I don't think that you know, get to the point where your heart can be open to another soulmate dog potentially until you're in the acceptance stage of those 5 stages of grief. And I think, as I write in Soulmate Dog, that the 5 stages of grief that you experience grieving a human are very much the same as they are grieving your soulmate dog, that you as you're going through the initial stages of shock and denial and even anger, and then you reach this bargaining or processing on your route to acceptance, I think it's in those early stages that the processing and devoting time to feeling all of those feelings and allowing them to come out and not suppressing them is so incredibly important. So in the coda, I explain that what I did, David, it was so profound. It happened very swiftly when Brady did die. And the very morning that he did die, I packed, I went right to the airport and I bought a ticket and I went to Patagonia. And I was not even particularly well, but I had to walk off my grief. That's how I process things. I walk things off. And so I took several flights with my backpack and ended up in the Andes. And I walked off in Patagonia my grief, and I was constantly journaling and thinking about him. But in those initial stages of the shock and the denial, and anger is never a stage that I happen to really go through. I kind of accept that this is, you know, life is and death are integral parts of the experience. So I don't, but in those, you know, initial stages, I just really devote myself to allowing everything come up and recognizing it, looking at it, not suppressing it. And I think those early stages are really important to actively do that, so that you don't let it fester and you let it come up. And then as you go through this sort of processing and get closer to the acceptance, that's just that nebulous time where you have no idea how long it is going to take. And there are moments where you are thinking of the happy times, or are there moments where you're, able to go back to your daily activities, and then all of a sudden you get reminded of something, as we do with grief, and the tears are back. But I just think honoring that process is incredibly important.
How did you discover walking worked for you? Because I think that's something that's you hit something there that I think is very important, is understanding what works for you, as opposed to asking everyone for advice. It's like, hey, find something that works for you. How did you discover walking?
That's interesting. Just as a child, I was always hiking with my mother, and I was always writing. I had a journal from the time I was a very small child. And so I remember when my mother died, I had this deep need to go for a long hike. And it was incredibly difficult for my father to say yes to this, but he could see how deep my need was, and he knew that I was experienced. I had, wilderness survival skills, all of that. So as a teenager, he allowed me to take my backpack and go off hiking for several days by myself. And so it was like something I've always known about myself. Is a need to be solitary and walk it off. And I discovered that early on, that walking and writing are my ways of expressing, my outlets for letting the grief come out.
Do you find that when grief is upon you, so to speak, that there's a comfort in knowing the solution? Not the timeline, but actually this process I know that works. Does that in itself bring comfort?
I have to say that when I'm in the throes of grief, I'm not really thinking of the word comfort. But that being said, there is a sort of a relief, a sense of relief, and a sense of gratitude, and also, almost a sense of safety, like
Yeah,
my
comfort is maybe
psychological
too clumsy a
health would
word.
be safe. No, but that's okay. It's just that, when you're grieving and it's so raw, nothing can really comfort you per se. But knowing that I can let it out, like it's almost like I read about this too. Like there's like a pressure cooker of emotions in your chest, so it's like you open that little valve, and like for me, the walking it out and writing it out is a way for it to come out. Yes, knowing that I know that those things help me deeply, it is a relief, and it does make me feel safe and such. Yes.
Because one of the reasons I ask is one of the things, and I hope it's one of the things that people will get comfort from when reading your book, is I find when I've coached people in the past, and I've experienced this for myself, when I'm in a sense of grief, if I can't find a way forward, and I don't mean a way to, like you said, just to let that valve open, that creates the problem. It's not the grief that's causing me the problem. It's I don't have access to a valve to let it go. And I would say, in a sense, that's traumatized me throughout my life because I've never really figured out a fail-safe that accesses it. I think what you said about letting that valve, to just let that pressure off from the heart, it is a perfect synopsis, because that's exactly what I've always struggled with, is hang on a second, there's this huge pressure that I need to release, and I don't know how to do it, and I don't know what's going to work and what isn't. And that's what I was alluding to when I said about the does it bring you comfort, is
I see.
to do so. I mean, is knowing that you have a process that's always worked for you kind of gives you, again, because this is going to sound clumsy, but it's an end goal, is a light at the end of the tunnel. Even if it's a long, dark tunnel, there is a light that you can walk towards. And with that, walking towards something can come an underlying comfort in darkness. Whereas I've always been the opposite. I've never been able to process that or find a way to open the valve. So the darkness is just darkness with chaos and everything and all that turmoil of emotions that go up and down. It doesn't get resolved. It just becomes stronger. And never being able to release that has always been problematic, because I'm like, hang on, there should be a solution somewhere. There should be this, there should be that. And it could just be an overactive logical brain trying to fix a problem that doesn't exist, which then becomes the problem. But it's always, and I've seen, like I said, I've seen this when I've coached clients and stuff like that. It's the, how do you let the grief go? You know, that like the old saying, you have to let it go. What, and it's helping people understand that if you find a process of letting go, you will actually always be okay.
Yeah, I think, David, that the most important thing in terms of allowing that valve to open is to express yourself. And I can see you express yourself very articulately. So
Thank you.
You have that deep capacity to express yourself. And I think the most important thing in allowing the grief to come out is being able to express it and express how you're feeling and articulate how you're feeling. And then in that, in doing so, you are letting it out. I also, in my process, I surrender the fact that I can't fix this. It's messy. Grief is messy. It's not linear. It's not logical. It defies logic. These five stages that Elizabeth Kubler-Ross writes about so beautifully, they're not neat. It's not like, oh, I'm in stage one. Oh, now I can identify this is stage two. It's messy. They all overlap.
I've passed my test. I'm on stage three. I've qualified.
Right. It's not, it doesn't work like that. And like grief defies logic. It defies reason. So I surrender to the fact that because I've loved so deeply, now I'm in the consequence of that, which is this loss, which can be overwhelming and dark. And I mean, I obviously went to great lengths to go to Patagonia to find a place where I could just walk it off in the mountains, and I did. I howled, I cried, I did all manner of things to you know express. But I think that's just how you kind of surrender that there is no solution. It's just, oh, at hand, I'm going to walk, at the end of my walk I'll feel better. I know I could feel just perfectly crappy at the end of this walk, but it's still helping the valve open and to express and for it to come out.
I like that change in a different direction. How did you and Brady meet?
So unlike you, I did not adopt him, although I have the highest respect for everyone who adopts a dog. I had had a German Shepherd when I was a child, who was deeply important to my family, and it was another. She was also my mother's dog, and so when she did die, that was sad in itself, because well, we all loved her, but she also triggered, you know, the grief I was already experiencing for my mom. But I so much wanted to have another German Shepherd. And, you know, I went through several years of undergrad and then my PhD. And I thought, okay, finally, I finished my PhD. I think I have the time that I could devote to a dog. And I guess because it was the first time that I was going to be responsible for a dog, and I didn't know how a German Shepherd rescue would go, like if I would be faced with healing trauma that I wasn't equipped to heal. And so that's what kept me from adopting. And so anybody in the animal community, I agree, and I submit that I could learn how to do that, but I doubted my own capacity for being able to do that, and I wanted to start off fresh at the puppy stage. And so that's how I felt at the time. Although I would very much love to adopt a dog that needed me and vice versa. And so I visited German Shepherd trainers who had puppies, and this one he had already been adopted and returned because they, and this didn't end up in the book, but the person who had adopted him thought he was too much to handle and too energetic, and they were in way over the head with a German Shepherd puppy, and so he had been returned to the breeder. And so I met him one evening, and it was just like that. It was the coup de foudre. It was the strike of lightning or the strike of thunder, whatever it is. And it was just like that. We were inseparable from that very first moment of meeting, and I had never experienced that. I'd never had love at first sight with a human being before. So this is the first time in my life that I experienced this love at first sight. And I mean, nobody could have kept me from him at that point, David.
No, I understand that. I understand that exactly. And it's better. It's even better when it's reciprocated, because the things about with animals that separates it from humans is they don't have any agenda. So they're not playing games with you. They're just showing you, constantly showing you what you mean to them. And it is as complex and as sophisticated as that can sound. It's that simple. They're just, nope, it's an open book. You're the best thing that's ever happened in the world, and I'm going to remind you every single day. And it's something remarkable, because we don't often experience that in personal relationships with other people. We often will feel that there's an agenda or a game, even with our closest friends, you know, or family or siblings. You can love them to bits, and they can, you know, be your best friend, but you might be aware of the games they play. And you know, and dogs do the same. Molly has her own little like ways that she wants things, but for some reason it's never held with the same contempt. It's just like, no, that's her character, it's all fun. But you know, when a human being does it, it's like, you're doing that annoying thing again. But when Molly does it, it's cute.
I agree with you. They don't. I think that's something that I learned also from Debbie McGillivray, is that this is fascinating. Dogs don't lie when they communicate, because as Debbie explained it, a lying energy is very heavy, and you actually telepathically cannot communicate a lie because the energy becomes too heavy and negative to transmit on that level. And so, you know, that's not a kind of communication that they can actually transmit. So on top of not having an agenda, they have this very, it's very pure what is what that connection is. And I would even submit that, based on my relationship with Brady, I learned to have higher quality relationships with humans, or not wanting to have someone in my life unless they were more like Brady. So I would even say that, you know, in my current relationship, that my person reminds me of Brady, that I don't feel conditions, and I, you know, don't feel like there's an agenda, and I feel like I took lessons from Brady on how to love and how to be loved.
Yeah, no, that makes perfect sense to me, because, and my mum's even joked that if a girlfriend ever came into my life again, her competition would be Molly, because there's a standard of how I'm going to be treated that's expected. It's not negotiable.
Yeah, I'm not sure that's a joke, David. I
No,
think
it's
she's
not. Not
spot
for me,
on.
it's not. Yeah. My mum says it's a joke, but I'm like, I don't think you appreciate how serious I would be about that. You know. Just are you able to explain how you opened up telepathically? And the reason I ask that is when I wrote my book on reincarnation, there's a bit at the beginning in the introduction where I explain to people that it's not my words. And that at the time of writing the book, I don't know how to explain what I could feel, feelings and seeing pictures. It was all into one thing, but it was a form of communication. And there were these, for want of a better word, guides, beings, whatever, that looked like they were talking into a well, and that well was connected to the top of my head. And I was writing what they would communicate. And I can't use words like say or tell me, because it was a combination of feelings, thoughts, images, and words all kind of rolled into one that I understood perfectly, but cannot articulate. But it was like I knew exactly what they were saying to me or telling me. And then I would put it down in English and never really could do it the same justice. So, what was that process of opening up telepathically for you?
Yeah, that's fascinating and very close to sort of how I felt when Debbie was training me in this way. But I think I would start by saying that, excuse me, I've been meditating for most of my life, and I would start by meditating, and she would tell me that that would be helpful, that you can't telepathically communicate with animals easily unless you're free of distractions. And so you have to be in a quiet contemplative space. So I would start out by meditating. And then she would explain to me that, you sort of like reach out to the animal and invite it to speak with you and ask permission. And then she would explain that some people can taste things that animals are trying to describe to them, or they can see pictures or colors, or that animals do communicate frequently through pictures. And so, with some of the animals that she put me in touch with, I would have the taste of a carrot in my mouth. If the horse was trying to say that it wanted more carrots, like what happened to its carrot treats that it stopped getting? And then it turned out that it really did stop getting carrots and was looking for them. But I had that taste of a carrot. So once your senses are opened and on alert, and you're just sort of in a state of openness, it's almost like that's it. You're just channeling. You're just absolutely receiving what's coming to you. And Brady was so communicative that Debbie would always say, Brady is a very advanced soul. He communicates so in such a sophisticated way that he would be, he there is a letter that he transcribed to Debbie that appears in the book, and it's every time I read it, it's extraordinary to me that he was able to communicate such high order thinking. So I could actually hear him. When it came to Brady, I could just hear complete words and sentences. It came through so easily. He was so adept at communicating that he made it easy for me. And then when I would go to speak with others, it wasn't always so easy. But there was one striking example that I do write about in the book, that a friend of mine wanted me to communicate with her dog. And her dog showed me pictures of some old antiques that her husband kept in a drawer. And she was just overcome, because indeed this is exactly it. There were these old antique metal pieces that he kept in a drawer, and she wanted some kind of proof of this. And so there she had her proof. They come across in different ways.
So, because interestingly, I've meditated for as long as I can remember. And I attribute also that prayer because I was raised as a Catholic. And to me, it was the same sort of process because just, you know, that silence of trying to listen. With the meditation, because there will be people that obviously they want to know, like, oh, can I start learning? You know, what's the process? And obviously, the caveat to that would be you should really do some research and see if you can receive proper training. But people that do meditate, where would you say would be good to explore a connection with their pets?
Yes, and then by the way, in Soulmate Dog, I do go through the steps that I take to communicate.
Okay.
So it is there. So it is all there laid out for someone to try practicing. But I would say that, you know, something that Debbie likes to do is to kind of identify the animal that you're communicating with, where they are. Brady, the German Shepherd in Connecticut, for example, and then to just ask permission to communicate and to receive. And if you have permission to do that, well, then just like you're not just going to be in somebody's space and just start talking to them.
No.
So it's sort of like reading. And then once that's done, you just, if you're in already a state of meditation, and then you just sort of like surrender to that and start this kind of like quiet listening to see what might come through. And your senses are all sort of alert, but a calm alert, so that they're just like, it's like radar being cleaned and opened to see what might come through. And Debbie's very emphatic that anybody can do this. It's just a matter of training your muscles. It's like a marathon runner. You train to do it and you can do it. It's just a matter of practice and not doubting yourself. She says a lot of people will say, oh no, I can't be right. I can't be right. And then the doubt kind of takes you out of it. So you have to like have a faith that it's possible. And then, you know, see the subtle message. It's very subtle. So you just have to kind of like wait and see what comes through. And then to keep doing it, not just one time and say, ah, oh, it didn't work.
Yeah.
It's just to keep, you know, keep trying it too.
That reminds me of, there's an American medium called Jonathan Edwards. I think it's Jonathan Edwards is his name. And I remember watching him probably 20 years ago. And somebody, or it might have been his autobiography, he was talking about what you were saying, like, just have faith in yourself, just trust. And he was giving a reading to a woman. And I think he kept seeing the Liberty Bell. And he was just like, he couldn't make sense of what it meant. And he never said anything. And the woman was talking, and he said he's trying to get a message, and he's getting really frustrated. And he eventually just says to this woman, I'm really sorry. The only thing I keep seeing is this, you know, Liberty Bell or this bell. And she understood it exactly. And he said, and it was a big lesson for him because he kept trying to understand every message that he was receiving. And he said, instead of just having faith to pass the message on. And he said, like, she knew exactly what it was. Nothing to do with her husband had got her that as a gift 2 weeks before, like this little bell or something. But because he didn't understand the message, he spent, you know, an X amount of time refusing to pass it on. But he got so frustrated.
Yes, that's
said,
a good example.
He just said, look, all I keep seeing is this picture of a bell. And he said, and I don't know what it means. And she, I know exactly what it means. And
that's such a good example of how not to doubt and to,
yeah,
you know, and to actually, you know, believe that that is part of the message. And so, yes, that's brilliant.
That's what enabled me to write my book, was understanding that I just had to write the words down as I felt them and not question them, not quiz, not question, just. And then once that flow stopped, stop writing. And
yes.
Then just sit down again another time, and if nothing happens, okay, you're not writing today. And then other days it would come back, and okay, now write because you're in that flow state. So where can people find you?
Let's
Website?
see. So I have a website, Michelle. Michelle, I would say out in the woods or skiing or behind my desk, but the michelleslater.com is my website. I am on Instagram as Michelle B. Slater. There's two L's in Michelle. And Soulmate Dog and Starving to Heal in Siberia are, found on Amazon or wherever. I like to support the indie bookstores. They can be ordered there too.
Fantastic.
Yes.
And lastly, and this is a completely off-topic, random question that I'd just like to ask everybody. If you could be anywhere in history, anywhere in time, because you've got some random time machine, where would you go? What music would you be listening to? And what car would you drive?
If I could go anywhere in history just to choose
Anything.
a point in time, well, I think that I would probably go to 1860s Paris, so I wouldn't be
Nice.
driving a car, and I would probably be listening to French classical music, and maybe I would be walking with Baudelaire somewhere on the streets of Paris.
That is absolutely beautiful. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, David. I've really enjoyed being on your podcast.
And there you have it. I hope you enjoyed that as much as I did. And as always, please do check out the websites. Look, check, read the book, look it up. Find out more. Maybe there's something inside you that would love to have that connection with another animal. And as always, thank you very much for watching. I do appreciate all of the support. Wherever you are, whatever you believe in, please take care of yourself. Be blessed.